Hello, and thank you for tuning in to this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. If you are a regular listener, then you know the drill. Come in, sit down, take your shoes off, grab a drink, relax. And if there is something you feel the need to share, get in touch. mark.ward@securityforum.org is the address. For any comments, ideas, or requests to join in. If you've got something wrong as well, heaven forbid, then by all means tell us. And if this is your first time listening, welcome. Great to have you with us, and congratulations, you made it. Take a look around and let us know what you think. This episode is another about Threat Horizon, but we're a bit of a swerve this time because we're not talking about the risks and dangers that it details, but more what lies behind it, more about the scenarios that we generate to explore consequences and plausible futures. We're kind of pulling back the curtain to expose the mechanics behind the illusions. And does that make me the Wizard of Oz or Toto the dog? That was it, wasn't it? Who, if I remember the movie, I think who actually did reveal the wizard. We have some wizards here to talk about this. Not me. I'm very much the Sorcerer's Apprentice in this one. But we have some adepts, magi, if you like, who can spin stories out of all manner of materials. Given the tools, they will finish the job. That's a pretty big build-up, so no pressure, guys. No pressure. First up is Matt Finch, who's currently an Associate Fellow at the Said Business School in Oxford, who we got to know last year when we were changing Threat Horizon to focus on scenarios. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Matt. Thank you for letting me join you.
Yeah, good to have you here. Scenario is a bit magical. Am I overplaying it a bit there? I don't know, there's an element of creation, I think, that makes me think that.
There is much an art as a science, and I think that is where the magic lies. That the ability to craft a vision of the future that really gets under people's skin, forces them to think differently, challenges their assumptions, that's not something you can just do by running the numbers. And perhaps that's where that magical metaphor you use really comes in.
Yeah, we've certainly seen that in workshops. That sort of moment people get it. There's something very satisfying about seeing them go through that process, definitely. But also here is Max Brook, an ISF research analyst and one of the co-authors of Threat Horizon last year and this year, who helped develop the scenario methodology. So if you want to blame anybody, blame him. He's run lots of workshops with members to develop their own views. Hello, Max.
Thank you for that, Mark. I think that's been my favorite introduction and opening sting from you so far. Looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, so do you know scenarios off by heart now? Do you use it to plan a trip to the shops, that kind of thing? It's just second nature.
Well, yeah. My better half might get a little bit frustrated sometimes as trying to bring on all the ideas of uncertainty for some of those smaller...
Plausible futures for all the meals you're going to be eating. Why is this... Yeah, it could be. Prepare for everything.
But yeah, it's interesting you say that, though, because one of the key ways that we actually started to implement the ideas of scenarios or get our members and some of our audiences to think about what this really means was from actually bringing it back to those smaller sort of details of life, trying to think about when you might set off from home to be the traffic or when you think the milk might run out.
That's true. Yeah, I wonder if that's the sort of why it does catch on with people. Matt, I don't know if you see that. That sort of there's a lot of people do kind of this already, but I suppose there's a bit more mechanics and methodology around doing it in business sense. But it feels like quite a human thing to do anyway.
Totally. I think the idea of dealing with uncertainty is as much whether you're taking a brolly with you to go out in the rain or not, what you think the weather will hold, planning your holidays. But it goes right back to when we were single-celled organisms, actually, that if you imagine... predators and prey, anticipating the future is always a really good move. If you're trying to eat something, you want to guess whether it's going to go left or right. And if you want to avoid being eaten, you want to guess whether the thing is going to pounce to the left or right. So it is really baked in very deep. The whole notion of the future is not necessarily about correctly predicting, but it's about having this story in your head of where do I need to go in order to be safe, in order to have the things that I need. And that just builds up to the institutional level.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's a great way to think about it, isn't it? Yeah, just that sort of, there is that evolutionary aspect to it for sure. Yeah, so Horizon the ISF doesn't just help you with your business, it helps you survive on the African veldt if you were ever to find yourself there. But anyway, just to dive into the scenarios. So Matt, our scenario is having a bit of a moment. I don't know if it's one of those things that, as soon as you think about something, you see it everywhere. But scenarios seem to be popping up in all kinds of places. I don't know, when you work with them every day, but I wonder, are they proving really popular at the moment? They're catching on a bit.
I think that's what happened is that during this century particularly, there's been a recognition that where we experienced stability, where we thought that things would always run the way they did today and yesterday, where systems were very stable, there have been so many upsets, the global financial crisis, 9/11, the election of Trump, the Brexit outcome, the pandemic, the Ukraine invasion. There are lots of things where it's not that they were totally unexpected by everyone, that no one had the expertise to see that this was a possibility. But in the general consciousness, say, a lot of institutions and communities were relying on the idea that the context wasn't going to change. So, you know, scenarios have been around since the early days of the Cold War. But I think perhaps some of the certainties of the late 20th century, where we thought we really knew how the game was played, a lot of people have been forced to confront the fact that their assumptions no longer hold true.
Yeah, I do remember a book that got a lot of traction quite a while ago by Francis Fukuyama, The End of History. Pretty sure that's... And they're not selling that anymore, I don't think, because we've got a lot of... There seems to be a lot of history. I don't know, Max, you did, I think, study this post-grad. So do you feel that as well? Just, yeah, there's a lot of change happening to a lot of things.
Yeah, I don't know if it's maybe we're creating a world, ultimately, that we can never find that stability that, you know, might have existed prior with just the rise of globalization, or maybe that also might be coming to an end, how we see it now, but just the interconnectivity with everything and everyone, that actually, as humans, we probably crave stability and we don't like change and we try and have that sort of quite linear existence, but actually we're just building these environments. And yeah, exactly as Matt was saying, I studied this and sort of first got interested with it looking at the Vietnam War and how that was sort of the first war that really looked at statistics and data and tried to correlate patterns and trends, but ultimately it didn't go exactly as planned, because that's not necessarily how things work and how you know, life pans out, and especially in sort of those sort of environments as well.
And even building off that, I think you mentioned globalization, where I think there is a change at the moment with the state of the world today. We are so much more connected through supply chains, through the mass transportation and mobility and networks of aircraft and shipping. We do feel the impact of things happening very far away, even more than historically. And when we combine that with information technology, the late Swedish thinker, Richard Norman, management thinker, he talked about the density and liquidity of information processing, like how fast could the information flow and how many operations could you conduct at any one point on a network. When you think about what my phone can do now compared to computers in the past, the other thing is that information moves so quickly that it also creates a kind of vulnerability, right? That things affect us that previously maybe wouldn't even have reached us.
Yeah. But I do wonder, though, if things do change as fast as we think. I mean, I know there's a lot of change out there, but equally, you know, look out my window, there's birds flying around. It's pretty quiet out there. I mean, there's not hordes of robots rampaging over this district.
Yeah, maybe in a way we sort of live in a time that we assume or we think everything's important and necessary. You know, maybe 100 years ago, a presidential election in a certain country or state might not have affected different, you know, the other side of the world. But actually, today we have this impression that it does. And obviously there's the far greater connectivity. But I don't know if there's that sort of self or that idea of self involvement with most things. And
yeah, well, it seems to be there's a lot of stuff going on, though. I think, you know, I think you're right. It's easier and quicker to find out about stuff. And some of those things can definitely affect you. I think that's very true.
And I think also that those institutions of global governance, I mean, particularly to the extent that we're thinking about information security, the very infrastructure of the internet, both at the technical and the content layers, you know, there was a kind of elements were taken on trust. Things were allowed to evolve in a certain way. There were assumptions about the stability of the world in which the internet was growing, to now that a domestic presidential election can have impacts that are global, that actually affect our ability to stay connected as a planet. So I think there's a lot of things there that maybe we didn't previously see the ramifications, even if they did it.
Yeah, and I think there are all kinds of forces working to create some instability, because there can be profit in that, and there can be, you know, ways to, you know, disruption from a technological point of view, because again, that's, you know, if you lever open the cracks, that's, you know, a place where you can insert a business or, you know, start to upset those incumbents. So I think that's a definite trend, but certainly on AI and those kinds of technologies, that can and that has, I'm sure that's worrying a lot of people, because it can inflict quite a bit of change on them. But is that why scenarios are having this moment, Matt, you think? Because organizers say, yeah, whatever happens, we need to be prepared, and scenarios help them with that.
Well, I think the interesting thing is scenarios are kind of a tool for reperception of your environment. So you can almost imagine that there's an island, like your business environment, which you perceive to have some control, and you figure you basically know how it works. And then beyond that island, there's a whole sea of uncertainties, which you perceive to be beyond your direct control, like geopolitics or climate change, whatever it is. And so the art of scenarios is almost saying, how could the sea come ashore in ways that change life on my island? But actually, the map you've drawn of the island and sea is a map of right here and right now. So it's about where you perceive whether you have control over, say, something like climate change, And the truth is, if you think of someone like a farmer on that island, I can't decide as a farmer whether it rains tomorrow or not. But maybe if I work together with other people in the community, I can still keep the farmland sustainable for a generation to come. So some of the forces that seem beyond my control might actually potentially be within my influence in the long run.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's, I think that's, as well as that changing perspective and getting people to work and think together as well, isn't it? I mean, we've certainly seen that in workshops, haven't we, Max? Just those useful conversations, because the ISF obviously brings a lot of peers together, and you know, getting them to sort of sit down and think and share their experiences is always good.
What's been your feeling in those workshops in terms of saying scenarios are having a moment? Do you feel like people came in with an appetite for something new, you know, like a curiosity about this new technology being brought into Threat Horizon?
Well, I having done sort of the old style Threat Horizon type workshop and the new style, yeah, I felt sometimes there was a bit of a duty. They felt like, oh, I'm at Congress or I'm at some place and I've got to do this. And then that really changed, certainly with scenarios. And I think that's another reason why we committed to it, was just that it's quite fun, actually. And, you know, it does give them a different, but genuinely does change their perspective. They can sit back and it's slightly outside the usual type of thing they can do and is useful too.
The way we used to approach Threat Horizon by going through a very binary threat perspective often gives the impression that there's a right or wrong, or there's a correct answer. And I think the most important thing we've done in workshops is tell these individuals who do tend to most of the time operate in environments where it is quite black and white between what they do. They'll implement a control, or they'll take an action which will remediate, I guess, a risk or mitigate some challenge the business is facing. And if we can take them into a room and basically say, okay, there's no right or wrong answer, we're going to discuss the future here. The debates, once the penny drops, which does occasionally take a bit of time, but people really engage with it and the conversations they have. And the best thing, or one thing I really appreciate about scenarios, is that we can apply a structure and a mechanism and a methodology to those conversations. So not just having a sort of a shoot the breeze conversation about everything, we can actually structure it and still get the value for us, but also for them as well with those conversations they have with peers.
Yeah, I think that rigor is useful. Otherwise, just hand waving, really. And I think there is some formality to it that works. And I think as well, haven't quite maybe emphasized enough, is that the scenarios aren't the important part. It's what comes out at the end. I mean, that's the sort of that change perspective and what happens next. I mean, that's big. Yeah.
I mean, for me, I think of this not as a futures methodology at all, but a strategic methodology. That if you imagine that map of the island and the sea, it's a map of right here and right now. We just play it out in order to say, oh, we didn't perceive that this could happen, but actually it mattered. And so it's always about the application and the implications rather than the fanciful future. And the number of times, even in my experience of recent years, where we said something would happen in 2050 and then it happens within months.
Yep.
And the point is, we were never trying to predict. Yep. We were just trying to stretch people and show them their blind spot. So in 2019, just before the pandemic and the bushfires in Australia, was doing some work on the future of local government over there. And one of the scenarios that seemed really outlandish to the people in the room was, by 2050, the climate catastrophe is so bad, you're having freak weather events, and you bring in internal domestic passports in Australia. So you need a passport to go from state to state. People thought this was crazy. Yep. And then actually in the new year after that workshop, you had people being driven into the sea because their coastal towns were on fire from bushfires. And then when the pandemic hit, they did close the borders between states.
Yes, all right.
So there'd been a kind of rehearsal, even though we'd been looking 30 years hence. So I think it is always about the here and now, even when you're talking about what seemed like a very long time horizon.
Yeah. We find, I mean, Threat Horizon does have quite a specific time bound, but we've certainly said that, Max, haven't we? Said in some respects, it doesn't matter because things can happen much more quickly than you expect. But you've thought about it, and to an extent, you're prepared.
We just try and think, use the scenarios and the approach as a vehicle to get to that point. Exactly. So ultimately, as much as we're creating four scenarios for each of the themes, we're probably never going to actually accurately depict what each of those features might be. But it's about the conversations that might develop, or some of those. And by preparing for one of them, you might prepare for an entirely different future that might come much sooner or much later. And it's about that thinking in a less sort of, like I said before, less linear way. And actually there's different planes that we operate on, and they have the influence across them as well.
I think one of the things I find really fascinating about what's happening, particularly with cybersecurity and foresight, and I'm also on the Strategic Foresight Working Group for the European Cybersecurity Agency in ESA. So I've seen how different methodologies are sort of coming into play. But I think, as you said, maybe Max, on a previous podcast, it used to be, in the new year, a bunch of institutions say, these are the things to watch on a 2 to 3 year line. And it's basically like playing whack-a-mole.
Yep.
We can't tell you when to hit, but these are the three moles to watch out for.
Yep.
And the idea that cybersecurity evolves on this very regular by the calendar cadence.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
It's just not the case at all.
Had discussions before and sort of that moments of struggling really, when actually, if you look at the threats that get published, really it's the same core underlying like threat or vulnerability to an organization or society or people, and it's just technology presents it in a different way. So if you look at things of deception, whether that's through, you know, misinformation or disinformation, today has been going on for centuries in the past, and it's about, you can track that over time and develop it, but it really does come down to things like trust and control and authenticity, and there's such all those sort of bigger macro problems. And I think if you can understand where they exist and look at that technology not as that rigid application of them in totally different ways, but more of a continuous way, then I think it opens up different layers and the ability to see it slightly differently.
Yeah, a lot of those reports we see are like weather, you know, tomorrow will be like today, but slightly different. But that does mean that they miss the storms, because, you know, they don't predict the storms, really. I mean, and I think that's what the scenarios, again, their value has, that you can get to some points where you think, actually, yeah, if this goes really nastily wrong, then there's a big, big problem approaching, and you have to, and thinking about that is useful. Because I think as well, we have found in workshops, as you'd expect, a lot of ISF practitioners, information security practitioners, are firefighting. They're in the trenches, you know, day to day. They're really busy, and just giving, it's a bit of a luxury to sit back and look further out, but it's really helpful, definitely.
Well, this is one of the things I wondered, is there's always a balance, right? That you don't want to outsource too much of your thinking, but yet we're always bound by time and resource and capacity. Like the fact is, if we had infinite time to scan everything, it wouldn't really do us any good anyway. So that trade-off of where is the right stimulus? And I mean, maybe that's something I'm interested in the discussions you've been having, is the extent to which these are actually provocations as well. And it's not just, you know, oh, we've looked in the crystal ball and here are the four things to watch out for. But these are things that get under your skin and just make you think differently. Is that something you've seen?
Yes, definitely. I think the, because we've talked to quite a lot of members, ISF members, about Threat Horizon and how it was done last year and how different it was. And they do like the fact that it is more encompassing than a lot of those other types of reports, which do dwell on the technology and just, you know, say what bad guys, cyber bad guys, are going to be doing next year, which is less useful. So yeah, I think we do see that sort of, and I think as well, it helps them talk to other parts of their organization, helps forge some of those connections, because it is talking in more general in a good sense terms, rather than general in a, you know, not enough detail type terms. So I think, yeah, it can help.
Yeah, to pick up on that, I think, that was a really poignant comment I think you made just before, Matt, about how if we had unlimited time and resources, there's not much value in just Mark and myself surveying, scanning the future and telling people what we think, because the best thing that we have in our workshops and when we communicate with our members is that we might all see the same news article, we might all be seeing the same problem, but our different contextual experiences and different positions and viewpoints, by combining them and communicating them differently, does often leave you with that thought that sort of lingers in the back of your mind, and it might be something you've come across before, or you might have turned that stone over but not thought any differently about it. And I think that's really where the value comes from it, and that's why we're so, you know, grateful for the position we're able to have with these workshops and to talk openly and freely. And I'm sure you've had that experience as well, that the value that can bring.
Yeah, definitely getting that range of experts in, the extent to which, you know, oh, actually having the space expert in the room, or someone from the culture industry, or for whatever line of work, it's not just CISOs and it's not just people in information security, but every sector, having an outside voice that sees something you don't normally see. We're all so busy, we're normally just in the, you know, like a horse in the blinders of business as usual, galloping towards the end goal, just to get a bit of peripheral vision. And as you say, the art of conversation, of just having other people in the room, is so powerful for that.
Yeah, certainly a lot of, when we've been doing the scenarios, it is quite, again, liberating and satisfying to sort of play them out and go, oh, right, okay. And just, you can see how some of these things start to link together and, you know, expose some of those, you know, again, mechanics that lies behind it. But I did want to ask, Matt, you mentioned there about it's not all InfoSec that uses these scenarios. So can you give us a sense of other places that are perhaps using these? There's one, I know we had a conversation before, and the one you mentioned about sort of solving conflict in Latin America, was it?
Yeah, so very famously, a scenario planner called Adam Kahane has done a lot of work going right back to South Africa and the end of the apartheid regime, but also the conflict between FARC and the government in Colombia, where when people were really disagreeing with one another politically to the point of physical conflict, you can still get people to come together on the common ground of an unwritten future and say, you and I both fundamentally disagree about this situation, but we know it has to be different. So rather than me telling you how I want it to be and you saying how you want it to be, what if we manufacture a set of contexts that we might have to deal with? And it tends to bring people together in ways where they can start to solve problems jointly, which makes me wonder what you were saying about talking to other parts of the business, that actually businesses and other organizations have different attitudes to risk, different procedures, even the meaning of a word can differ. You know, as Jamina, your previous guest, said, even the meaning of the word divorce can differ in a political or legal debate. So I think one of the things interesting for me is as the role of the CISO evolves, as Paul Watts likes to say, how do you have a way of talking about these issues that makes sense to not just to other parts of the C-suite, but other parts of the whole organization?
Yeah, I think it is. That's, again, part of the value of it, just that it does expand that horizon for one, you know, using that that very well very well-worn word in the report. But I think, but it does help because, again, it's sort of lifting people out of the trenches. It's getting them to think that in that bigger context, it's not all about technology, and it does talk in less jargonistic ways about things. And it starts to expand the range of words they use and how they understand them as well. And certainly we've seen in a couple of organizations connections made with enterprise risk or sort of chief risk, you know, the risk departments or other parts, solely because the scenario is they're thinking about saying suddenly actually there's a bigger risk here, and that flows up towards the risk registers in those organizations. And it's been a good process for them. It's definitely helped.
Yeah, I think probably our end goal with Threat Horizon and the report and the product, how we see it, is probably for two people in the same organization to pick it up and see it as two completely different things. But actually, it gives them that platform and that mouthpiece and the vehicle by which they can actually communicate their different challenges and the risks associated with it on the same page. And I think whether you look at the troubles somewhere in Latin America, or you can actually think about that same problem and that same issue in a business context, as ridiculous as it might seem, but actually it's about bringing those people together and saying, this is how it might play out from my perspective. Actually, we need to be on this journey together, and actually we can talk about that and cross collaborate with it.
And I think actually for the private sector as well, as much in an increasingly networked world, at every level, these things that were maybe not traditionally seen as the remit of business do become the remit of business. So working with very large multinational corporations, often it's very much about governance. You know, when we're so big that our strategy is basically just M&A, really global governance becomes the issue. But even if you're a small business, there's so many aspects now in the age of social media about reputation, different values. You think of that dentist from Milwaukee, where he was from, who shot Cecil the Lion and was then pilloried on social media some years ago. You know, he'd spent tens of thousands of dollars to hunt a lion in Africa, posted it online. But then actually his reputation was so destroyed. That wasn't a financial interaction anymore that he'd paid to go hunting, which he thought was fine according to his values. His values had been called into question by a global audience, and you could just be a baker in a town and suddenly your reputation comes into a global spotlight in this age. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, there are consequences to those things, aren't there? Yeah, I mean, certainly you see that in my kids, just the way that they shy away from interacting on some social media, and just, some of their conversations are quite guarded because they know, in the wrong moment, with the wrong words, or then they could be held accountable for that in all kinds of ways they did not expect. I don't know if Max, you see as a younger person, again, speaking of your generation as a whole. Whether the consequences are something that you consider.
Well, I think personally, I'd try and keep away from it as much as possible. And but I don't know. It's a difficult one. I think it's. People are probably maturing in that sort of area of life much more quickly, maybe, actually, because they do understand the ramifications. And but then conversely, and I think that's something that we probably will touch on quite heavily in the report this year, is this idea of people being identified more by their groups and their beliefs and what that actually means going forward. And I think that is a largely increasing sort of phenomena that actually is played out so much online and in a digital world, rather than that actual in-person, face-to-face sort of element that it might have been in the past.
And I think this speaks also to diversity in the profession. Like, I quite often reflect in strategic conversations, I'm white, I'm a man, I'm a native speaker of English. If I'm in a relationship with a woman, I will have certain experiences of life and how I'm treated in life and how I move through life, that even though they're about my day-to-day life, they affect what I see in a business context and the kind of conversations I have. And actually, diversity and difference within groups that are doing strategy work or foresight work is so vital, because as you say, Max, if things like identity come more into question, people who've had different experiences of how they're treated based on their identities and so on, it actually really affects those questions at the level of what are we going to do or not do as an organization. To have that perspective and experience hugely enriches the quality of strategic conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly that's been, I found that with conversations with Max about just, you know, when we're talking about some of the interviews we've done and sort of reactions to things, you know, just Max's perspective on this, even though you say you shy away from social media, you do have a very different view of how those things work. And I think certainly the a couple of interviews we've done, it's been clear that, you know, that younger generation moving into organizations is going to change them hugely, because, you know, we did have that conversation with one organization where their younger people had loyalties into their friend groups first and were sharing lots of information they shouldn't because it was, you know, proprietary. But they were like, oh, well, why is that a problem all of a sudden? Because, you know, I trust these people so much and I only work for you. And I think that was a really difficult thing that they're going to have to negotiate in the future.
Yeah, it's the very much my world is my world, and that's the only one I can understand or see. And yeah, I think that's definitely what we want to do with Threat Horizon going forward, is to open this as far as possible and to talk to people in a plethora of different roles and experiences as well, because I think that's the most vital thing as we try and push this forward and really challenge what we do and how people engage and their perception of what it is that we produce on this annual basis is something more than just that, you know, do X and Y for Z in 2 years' time sort of viewpoint.
But I think that speaks to this fundamental question of like truth, trust, and credibility. Like, what information do we believe in? Is it about humans believing one another, or humans believing machines, or machines trusting certain sources? And it's moving maybe from a model where it's like, we trust you because you've looked in the crystal ball and told us to whack these three moles, to we've created the space for you to have a conversation. And I imagine, I don't know, but in the workshops you've been having, or for ISF members using the new Threat Horizon, part of it is a sense of trust that's actually built on mutual relationships and conversation, that it's not just that you're sort of handing down wisdom from the mountain. No. We're all working together.
Yeah, I think so. I think, yeah, that is a very good point, that they are, yeah, we don't know. I mean, I think we changed Threat Horizon because it did use very strong hard words like predict. And we were like, well, actually, how right are we? And we did go back and look, and we did an okay job, but, you know, we never did any rigorous statistical analysis. Are we more or less likely to be right about these things? But I think scenarios, it's like, we don't know, but we'll find out, and we'll do these plausible futures. And then what emerges at the far end is what we actually need to react to. It's not the scenario itself, but, you know, what they imply at that end of it. Definitely we've seen that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's two elements as well, which is, one is that because the scenarios are deliberately constructed to spot blind spots, it makes sure that they're useful, even if they're not predictive.
Yeah, that's true.
But the other side, I was talking to an astronaut of all people, and they were saying when they get trained, they have to do underwater escapes, which is where basically they put you into a helicopter cockpit and then they drop it upside down in a swimming pool in the dark. And they've told you how to get out and you have to practice getting out. And the astronaut said the point is not just that you've trained to escape a helicopter crash at sea, but actually when you're in this situation of complete disorientation and panic, you can still think at least enough to get through. And I think scenarios are a bit like that as well, that you're put into these outlandish worlds, but it helps you to think when something wild happens, and not just what the scenario said, but even if something else happens, you've had a bit of a stretch. Does that make sense to you, Max?
Yeah, I think it gives you that moment of the pause and the clarity, I think, because it's so easy to get tied up and that whirlwind. And if people are firefighting on a day-to-day basis, that it's, you get caught and trapped in that. And actually, if you can take a step back and think about the nuance that exists with everything, it actually is so valuable to be able to do that. But as you said, you might need some fairly wacky experiences to be able to get that, or some unusual scenarios or some difficult conversations.
But I think, but yeah, the value is in that, letting them think the unthinkable, because they don't want to think that. I think as well, these day-to-day jobs are like, yeah, I can't worry about that because I've got to fix this now. And that is a bit of a luxury to be able to take them out for a couple of hours or half a day and just sort of say, look, you know, and consider those things and consider the consequences as well. I mean, that's the, because as well, I suppose, I mean, just to wrap this up a bit, I suppose what's also important is what happens after. I mean, that process as well. I don't know if Matt, you sort of get involved in that, sort of, you talked about governance a bit, but whether that's the next step for these things, checking that your organization can handle the changes that might be implied by these things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's actually the prime purpose, that for me, scenarios work is always anchored in who's going to use it, what is it meant to explore, and how is it going to be applied, even to the level of how does the business like to receive information? Is it a big, long report? Is it a presentation? Is it something more interactive? This is always strategy work. So its value ultimately comes in nourishing a decision, even if it is through bringing about surprise. And I was lucky enough to contribute to a set of scenarios done for the Ukrainian government by the All-Party Parliamentary Group for Future Generations. It's available now on their website as a public document, so people can look that up. But those were scenarios for the year 2040. And you've got to think that if the Ukrainian government, in the middle of the conflict it's currently in, is taking the time to think, what are things looking like 17 years from now? How will this war be remembered? They see a value to that perspective. And the value must be that it nourishes decision-making or innovation or some kind of collaboration. We're not in the science fiction business entirely. We're really in the strategy business.
Yeah, if you need a good marker for how valuable this can be and what use it has, then yeah, that right there must be part of it. But just again, to wrap things up, I don't know, Matt, if you've seen, are all scenarios, the things they produce and develop, are they all different? I just wonder, is there any commonality here in terms of the what they get people to do? Or, and I know you've sampled and been involved in a lot of different projects, but yeah, is there any sort of common element here that they do produce at the end of these things, at the end of the exercise?
Well, I think it is always relevant to the original purpose. Does it nourish a decision that needs to be made or even a direction that has to be taken? I mean, it's like, again, going back to that single-celled organism, do I go left or right? I have to make that choice. But sometimes the really good work doesn't just give you answers you didn't expect. It shows you questions you didn't know you needed to ask. So I think you both alluded to earlier the idea of like a sort of aha moment in a workshop. Where you think, oh, I never thought this could happen. And of course, you know, scenarios, to the extent that they come out of a tradition, say the Shell oil company in the 60s, it was the notion of creating a geopolitical context that was so outlandish at the time. People said, well, oil could never reach that price per barrel. And they say, well, this is the context in which it happens. And then with the formation of OPEC and the consortium in the Middle East, it does happen. But you need to go upstream. You need to go outside of your own immediate environment, your own immediate role, and acknowledge that stuff in the context. But precisely so that you can make a choice or a decision, and the good work is tailored to the specifics of the user's needs. That's where I'll be with that.
Okay. Max, I don't know about if there's a particular favorite scenario that someone's generated, or if there's one you've gone through, you kind of think, oh, that seems, or if just anything about them that sort of regularly resonates, you go, yeah, I thought of that a while ago.
Yeah.
I'm in bed, or I don't know.
I don't know if there's an individual one, but something that stuck with me a little bit was when we had a conversation just explaining scenarios and going through the methodology and just giving that introductory presentation fairly recently. And we were just presenting some ideas, some very basics about the threats and risk and potential opportunities for three completely different scenarios and futures and themes that we were looking at. And as we were going through this, sort of the audience started commenting, saying, oh, well, there's a connection between this scenario and this theme and here. And it was very much the sort of exactly moment for us. So actually, we're not just here to try and tell stories about this, that this is, as I said before, on this is the process we go to get to this point. And actually, these threats and risks and opportunities might exist across multiple different scenarios, because it isn't the scenario that we're trying to depict here. It's about how you can be prepared, how you can take those early mitigating steps and actions, but also to see the positive and the opportunity that might exist in there as well. Because exactly what organizations like Shell have done is not just sort of be the town crier with the bell and try and tell everybody that the world is not the end of the world is now, but sort of have the actual approach to think positive about the future as well.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's, yeah, I remember that workshop, and there was, you know, not just good moments for the people taking part, but for us as facilitators as well, just that, oh yeah,
sure,
kind of moment. And that was, yeah, understand the world in a different way and a bit of a deeper way as well. So yeah, definitely the surprising aspects of it are always good. But just to wrap things up, I hope this has been a magical recording for our listening experience for everybody that's downloading it and listening. Thanks, everybody. Tell your friends, tell your colleagues, and the audience is growing. Be part of that audience. You can now find ISF podcasts on all major podcast platforms. Look for our page on Audio Boom where you can subscribe to make sure you don't miss an episode. And who would want to do that? The podcasts are also available at securityforum.org, where you can also learn more about ISF research, tools, and guidance.